Once again to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with my good buddy, Vato Loco, Jason McClellan.
Hello, Alejandro.
How you doing?
I am swell, friend. How are you?
Not too bad. Getting
Excellent.
Ready for Big Turkey Day.
Turkey Day. You're hilarious.
Yep, although you and I are both vegetarians, as most of the listeners, I think, know.
Yeah.
By now, so we won't be eating turkeys. We're more likely to hug a turkey.
That's right.
To eat it.
That's right.
That's how great we are. We're pretty cool.
I just found out today that turkeys are even more awesome than I thought they were because they actually grow beards.
Really?
Yeah, out their chest. So it's more like chest hair, but they call them beards. And they're like wiry whiskers, and they grow with age. So the longer the beard they have sticking out of their chest, the older they are. So turkeys have beards.
So their chest hair gets so out of control that it looks like a beard.
That's right. They're turkeys from the 70s. They like to show off the chest hair and be sexy. So.
Wow, that is something that's really funny.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Turkeys are pretty funny.
Yeah, that's kind of creepy, actually. Creepy turkeys.
It's sexy.
I know a lot of creepy turkeys. All right. Well, the show is really cool today. We have a great guest. His name is Cameron Pack. And he just wrote a book called Restored Project Blue Book UFO Files, June 1947 and before. And people are probably like, June 1947? Everything didn't start till then. How can he write about June 1947 and before? Well, the Blue Book Files investigated a lot of cases that early. And this is what he did that is really cool. A lot of those files were handwritten or really difficult to read, if not nearly impossible. So he painstakingly did the research to figure out what was in the text of all those files and then recreated all of that, typed it all up so it's legible. And when you look into it, there's some pretty incredible cases that they covered back then, way at the beginning of the Air Force's investigation into UFOs. So really cool that he did this. I was really excited about it because I love all these old files. So we talked to him about what got him into UFOs, why he chose these early files to look into, what he loves about the early cases, because as we talked with him, he was a MUFON investigator and he looked into a lot of different aspects of the field, but he likes those old cases. So I like those old cases too. They're pretty cool. But before we do that, first I want to thank George Knapp because he kept me up really late last night. We're talking UFOs on Coast to Coast to AM last night. So I want to thank him for that. So if you're one of those Coast listeners, you know, go download the show and check it out. Even though Coast to Coast, I mean, I don't know of any other radio show like this. And maybe you do, Jason, but like, you know, people download the shows and create YouTube videos and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's almost like every show people out there make a big deal out of and post everywhere and discuss. I mean, there's discussion groups out there and everything around this show. I mean, that's kind of cool.
It is. I mean, that's an entire world by itself. I mean, there's an entire coast culture. So, yeah, it does spawn discussion, and it lives on for a long time. So, yeah, I mean, there are other shows like that with gigantic followings and just, you know, groups of people who like to discuss it after the fact and keep it going and spread it around. But Coast is sort of a beast of its own.
I mean, you're a big Howard Stern fan, and I mean, he's huge, you know, but I don't even know if he has, like, you know, people gathering after every show to discuss what was on the show. And
well, he's another example. I mean, there is a giant giant Stern culture, and but Stern, you know, does more than coast in the media sense with you know, Howard Stern TV and other, you know, video aspects to the show and all the ancillary characters on the show. It's a giant world too, but Coast is definitely one of those interesting beasts, and I mean, I've got to hand it to the Coast listeners. They're diehards, and man, I don't know how they listen to that much radio, because it's a lot of radio.
Yeah, it is. And what's really cool, of course, which I'm really excited about, which is one of the things we talked about, is that we're going to have George Norrie and George Knapp at the next UFO Congress this February. So that's pretty exciting. I think that's really cool. I don't know that they've been together at a conference before. And, you know, that's going to be a lot of fun.
And what people don't know is we're going to have them both match up against each other in mud wrestling.
That's going to be really cool. Who are your bets on?
Oh, my bet's definitely on Knapp.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Knapp can take him.
I think so. A little more grizzly. He's a little more out there, you know, out in the field doing investigations.
Right.
So
that's right.
It makes him kind of tough. And it's probably not his first mud wrestling experience. Where
I think he's been around.
Yeah, so you can go to UFO Congress, of course, to register for that, or openminds.tv. But before we get into our interview, the other thing that you can see at openminds.tv is UFO news. So we keep up on all the news that's in the mainstream and otherwise. And, of course, Jason and I every week talk about our favorite story of the week. And, Mr. McClellan, which story would that be for you?
Oh, I'm sure you remember there was an interesting video that emerged last week. And this is the case from Colombia, from a place called Pereira, Colombia. And this is an incident that happened earlier in the month, but it just made news last week when a YouTube video was uploaded showing this fleet of orb UFOs, this armada of UFOs, filling the sky in Colombia, hundreds of these white orbs in the sky. And the video shows, you know, massive people on the sidewalk just walking by and stopping, and everybody's pointing and looking up in the sky at these strange orbs drifting through the sky. And a lot of people, you know, there were certainly people saying, oh, there are UFOs in the sky. These are alien spaceships, but there were plenty of people also immediately looking at this video and saying, that's obviously a hoax video. And the major red flag that people were pointing out was the fact that you would see the camera showing the crowd of people on the sidewalk pointing and looking at the sky. And then the video would cut to a shot of the sky. You'd see the objects in the sky. Then there would be another cut, and then back to the audience. Then a cut back to the sky. This back and forth with cuts, no continuous motion showing the audience and showing the sky. So that made people think, oh, you know, they're probably stopped looking at a potential suicide jumper on the side of a building or something else going on. There was nothing in the video to connect the two events to say, oh, they're obviously looking at these spheres in the sky. So a lot of people were debating whether or not this was actually a real video. But there was a newspaper, a Colombian newspaper, La Tarde, and it addressed the incident as well. But what it did, it had two stories, but the most important story was saying that happened before this video was posted, talking about these students at a local university, 400 students. They got together and arranged this protest, basically, and they were protesting healthcare reform, I guess. So what they did to protest and to be symbolic, and I don't really understand what the symbolism is behind this, but they tied potatoes to balloons and released 400 balloons with potatoes attached to the bottom. But 400 balloons, or potato bombs, they called them. And these 400 balloons filled the sky, and that's what this crowd of people was watching, these 400 balloons in the sky. But, of course, there are plenty of people who don't buy that explanation and think that's some cover-up excuse that the newspaper put out to hide the fact that there were aliens over Colombia. But regardless, Alejandro, this story was interesting because it's another great example of just how strongly people form opinions based on limited information. And no matter what comes out after that, they're firm in their belief, and they've decided what it is, and they know better than any other authority that can tell them. So,
yeah, it's funny because that reminds me of the drone over Brazil, the protest there, and how
right. It's
just, you know, the camera angles and everything were exactly from, you know, this camera that was being filmed or filming the protesters, you know,
right. In
the exact same place where the people obviously took video of this thing, and when that came out that it was just this camera, yeah, people, even at least one big researcher in this field just refuses to believe that what it really turned out to be. There's a couple of interesting things about this story, too, that I think that it's funny that they're having their own healthcare reform. I mean, they're not protesting our U.S. healthcare.
Right.
They're protesting their own issue. And like you mentioned, the potatoes. I don't understand. Someone had mentioned maybe they're like potato bombs. Like the plan is that they launch these things, and then when the helium runs out, then they come falling, crashing to the ground, and these potatoes kind of donk people in the head or something. I don't know.
Well, that's gonna injure a lot of people, and they're gonna need health care, and it's gonna point out how flawed their health care system is.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean they refer to them as potato bombs, and yeah, it's interesting. So you could be right, Alejandra. They could be planning this this aerial attack with potatoes.
Maybe we'll have to launch one and then put a GoPro camera on the potato to see what happens when it falls to the lifetime.
Yeah, that's pretty dangerous.
Yeah, that could hurt somebody. But at least we get some good video of someone looking up at a potato falling on their head.
Well, that's right. Well, the newspaper La Tarde, they did do a follow-up story and said, you know, a lot of people saw this video and they're saying that there's UFOs over us. But, hey, guys, it was these potato bombs, these 400 balloons launched by these students. And there are pictures of the students with all the balloons. And, of course, that led some to question the authenticity of that as well, or questioning the balloons, because in the picture, in the photo of the students with their balloons, you see white balloons and green balloons and even some black balloons. And people seeing the video and looking at the other photos of the objects in the sky say, oh, there's only white objects there, so I don't see any green or black, so that can't be it. But as we know, Alejandro, things in the sky can look quite different than they do on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. My story for the week. It was really hard to decide because I think we had some really interesting stories, and I think I'm even just going to at least mention the headlines, like
okay. An
ecologist talking about humans not being from Earth, and he has some really interesting arguments there. A fireball over Oregon, which got pretty popular, you know, UFO over England. I really like this one that you found where it says scientist proposes a bond that will pay out when aliens are discovered. That's a pretty cool story. So a lot of really neat stories, and this is really neat too, where our friend Peter Robbins has recorded some audio book kind of things that kind of summarize his book on Rendlesham Forest. So you could go download those, and they're only like $2, and there's several of them. You know, and Rendlesham Forest, of course, is a very important case. And then the proceeds for that are going to a movie that he's helping to produce. So that's pretty cool. Everybody should check that out. But the story I chose is this UFO captured near an Indiana tornado. And I wanted to kind of hear what your views on this one were, too. I think this video is really cool. So this kid, of course, unfortunately, in Indiana and Illinois last week, there were a lot of tornadoes. They estimated like 16 of them touched ground. There was a lot of devastation and everything. And on the 17th, this kid, you can see on his iPhone, and his comments are really interesting, saw this luminous object up in the clouds, and the clouds are really moving quickly and everything. And but this object is staying pretty still up there. It kind of moves back and forth, and I think it's a really interesting video. So that's kind of cool.
And it is an interesting video, and you're right. It is. It does appear to be a very luminous object. It's surprising how bright it is. You know, it could be catching the sun just right, the sun peeking through the clouds there, and but it's really difficult to get a sense of the size of it. You know, I let you know that initially when I saw it, I was speculating that it could be like a plastic bag or something swirling around and the crazy winds going on there as the tornado's forming, but really impossible to tell. I think it's pretty fascinating video and watching this thing move. I mean, it doesn't seem like something drifting in the wind, but then again, I've never been up in a tornado like that. So.
Yeah, you know what I think? Yeah, so it's kind of cool. It's a cool video. Everybody will have to go check that one out. That's a story that I recommend people check out. But, of course, you can see all of these at openminds.tv. All right. Well, thank you, Jason, for joining me once again to talk about the news.
It is always my pleasure to talk about UFOs with you, Alejandro.
So without further ado, let's talk to UFO author Cameron Pack. All right. I am excited to have Cameron Pack on the phone. And as I mentioned earlier, Cameron has just put together this Blue Book Files from June 1947 and before, and we'll talk about that. Welcome to the show, Cameron.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is kind of neat. I'm intrigued because I'm very intrigued also with the Blue Book Files, so I'm interested in hearing more about that. But I guess to start off with, what got you interested in the topic of UFOs?
Well, I had a sighting in 2003 that basically revived a childhood interest that I almost had lost by that time. And, you know, so it was kind of up close and personal, but a little different than most sightings that are a close encounter, because I couldn't make it any shape. There were only lights, but I knew, you know, something strange was overhead. So that, you know, that in and of itself kind of got me back in the topic. So
cool. Can you give us some details on the sighting?
It was about 1 a.m. or so, and this was, you know, obviously really late at night. Nobody else was out. I was coming back home with a friend of mine who was driving his car, and we were in our neighborhood. And basically, you know, from a far distance, I saw this cluster of lights that looked no different to me than these big cargo planes that come into NAS Oceana, the local air station for the Navy here in Virginia Beach. And, you know, so I thought nothing more of it. And as we get closer, you know, we're going through our neighborhood, you know, not really, you know, doing anything special or anything. But you know, I realized that we were coming up on the same set of lights again, and it was much lower than I originally thought. And it was a small formation of about three lights, one in the front, two in the back, kind of like a classic triangle shape. And it was at most probably about three stories off the ground. And, you know, we came up to it and we're both staring at the same thing, but not really saying anything to each other until, you know, I yell out, you know, stop, you know, that because we got so far up, it became obscured by the tree line that was there with the houses. And, after we stopped, you know, slowly it came out again, and it was just moving parallel to the ground in a straight line format, you know, heading right toward us, basically about 50 feet away. And it probably took about a minute or so to get above us, and, you know, during that time, we're just trying to figure out what it is. We see no structure, no shape to it. The sky that night was particularly like devoid of any light or stars or anything. It was just a very bizarre experience overall in that regard. So, you know, the formation of lights is probably like, say, at most the tips of all the points on a jet, you know, and if you make those into a triangle, you know, 30, 40, 50 feet, you know, at most.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, it had turned, and I think we were kind of arguing about, you know, we had a disposable camera actually at the time, but we couldn't get the thing to work, so we were arguing about that. We didn't mm-hmm. see it turn, but it did turn, and next thing you know, because it had gotten right overhead, and then next thing I know, you know, I'm looking at the back end of it with the two backlights, you know, with no shape or structure, you know, at all, of course, but, you know, that's obviously the back that was, you know, away from us at first, and it just makes a god-awful noise that I still, you know, I've never heard anything quite like it again. It was like an organic kind of machine-like screaming. I can't really
wow.
describe it anything else than that, you know, and it just, you know, slowly drifts away, making this noise that it wasn't making prior. You know, no, there was no noise, you know, until it had turned, which we didn't witness it turning, but, you know, it takes another minute and a half for it to drift away, and, you know, that was it. We tried following it, you know, we tried going through the neighborhood, getting out on the main road, but it was just too late.
Right.
So very odd.
Yeah, so that propelled you into getting more involved with researching the subject?
Yes. It took me a little while, you know, but I began looking at on the internet, checking books out from the library, you know, going beyond what, you know, the average person would do. I think in that era of 2003, there wasn't a whole lot on the TV at that time. It was just like the beginning of that new TV kind of era and, you know, revitalization era for the subject. But I was just surprised at how much was out there that if you go looking for it, you can find it in terms of information and incredible information on top of that. So.
Yeah. So what I find interesting, in 2003, how old were you at that point?
I was, that would be when I was 20, I believe. Yeah, 20 okay. at that time. So, yes.
So it's interesting, you know, that as a child you were interested in the topic and then you lost touch with that interest. And it seems like that happens with a lot of people. And for you, do you think that you, during that time where you really weren't thinking of it, did you feel there was a lack of credibility, or did you just kind of busy with the rest of your life?
I honestly think it was a combination of that, both of those, as well as the fact, because every show that they would have on TV at that time, it would be like the first 30 minutes would be talking about people that believe in UFOs and had experiences, and then the next 30 minutes was spent, you know, debunking everything. You know,
right.
Kind of, yeah. And so that was a big factor, and unfortunately I was becoming a component of mass society and conformity, so, you know, it's not really popular to back then, you know, to believe, you know, that kind of stuff. And that, you know, as a young kid, that kind of played an aspect. But when you have an experience, I think that's more of a life-changing aspect of it.
Which makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's just, I think that's interesting, and I like your opinion on this, and that, you know, I feel kind of the same. I had kind of an interest as a kid, and then I watched the shows. But like you said, they weren't very good. They would end with debunking, so I would kind of end the same, maybe on the fence. For me, it was, you know, the Disclosure Project and seeing all those witnesses and seeing that the news didn't cover it that got me involved. But I think that's what happens with a lot of people. It's not necessarily that they're against the topic or that they just don't think much of it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Similar to you, you had to have a sighting that got you compelled to do something, and then I had to see the disclosure information, whereas if I wouldn't have ran across it, I might not have gotten re-involved or involved with this stuff.
Yes. I think that's it exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Summarized.
So you've done a lot of work. You were involved with MUFON. You started up your UFO club in Virginia. Do you think that you and your club were sometimes the, because you guys got to impress the kind of the impetus that getting other people turned on to the topic?
I think, unfortunately, I say unfortunately, but I think it did, but you know, maybe somebody who was had questions about it or just wanted to go and see what the club was about, you know, get more research on the topic, you know, hear what people think. That we definitely had a lot of people that were doing that, as well as even, you know, one or two skeptics that just kind of wanted to come out and hear what people thought as well, which was kind of odd to me. I guess I would have never imagined that until I started the club, that I realized that, you know, some people were skeptical and just kind of wanted to kind of debunk it in their mind. I guess that would be the only logical way just to make sure there's nothing to it.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, but I think the majority of people, as I think you were alluding to earlier, is kind of like they don't really care about it at all, or either way, they just, you know, getting by with their lives is fine. And, you know, if something falls out of the sky, or you know, they hear something talked about that just really strikes them, I don't think anything's going to really change their mind or get them, you know, all of a sudden an uproar about, you know, going and researching a topic,
right,
or, you know, carrying a long conversation about it with somebody, you know. And so I think everybody's just at their own place, you know, when they're meant to be, as we move forward in society, I guess.
Yeah. So you then became a MUFON investigator, and what, how did you find MUFON, and what inspired you to actually become an investigator?
I had actually began to distribute some of my, there was another set of files I had found in 2005 that I had worked on besides these Blue Book files. You know, and Blue Book's nothing new, but I actually had found some FOIA, via FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, my local police department. They had some UFO documents that dated back to 1976.
Interesting.
I got this big file of, you know, it was probably about 70 different reports. And I didn't really do too much with them over the course of next 3 or 4 years, but in 2009, I really, you know, thought, well, why should I just sit on this stuff? Because it seems like nobody else has it. I tried, you know, looking for it on the internet, any other departments or police departments, sheriff departments. Nobody really knew about it. It was just Virginia Beach in Virginia that seemed to have it. You know, so I thought, well, why don't I just distribute it to various UFO researchers? And I did. And I chose, like, you know, Center for UFO Studies, former head of MUFON, John Schuster. And the person that had the most impact on me, I think, was Susan Twycek, the Virginia MUFON state director.
Hmm.
And, you know, so she had actually said, you know, when I was talking to her on the phone, she had could take my call. She happened to be at home that day. And she said to me, yeah, you know, my husband, you know, Rob was on a conference call with, like QFOs and, Fund for UFO Research, you know, the few organizations that are involved with the UFO Research Coalition. And Mark Rodiger, the director of QFOs, I believe it was him. She was saying, yeah, you know, we got this file of UFO reports from this Cameron Pack, you know, it's, yeah, you know, who is he, or, you know,
who is this,
you know,
guy?
Nothing bad, you know, but so she actually said, yeah, you know, it was something I should probably find out because it's happening in my state. And so within, I guess, a couple weeks later, I gave her a call. So that alone, talking with her, and she offered me a chance to speak at one of her conferences that year in 2009. I kind of went from there, became an investigator. Around the same time that I spoke, and just kind of formalized more of my research beyond the amateur aspects of it, I guess you could say. So.
Cool. Yeah, I know the Switex pretty well. I love those guys. They're great. So
very good.
Yeah, that's fun. So when you started doing investigations, was there something unexpected? Like, what did you have a set of expectations when you went into it? And when you started doing that, were those confirmed, or were there discoveries you made where things were a little different than you thought?
I would have to say I kind of really had, I guess you could say, an open mind,
mm-hmm.
kind of like a clean slate, not really expecting too much or too little, not really. I didn't know what to expect. I knew that if I went into it, I would kind of find out what I needed to get out of it, I guess you'd say.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, in the beginning, actually, of my working on cases, I think I honestly had very good witnesses that I spoke with, and I didn't have anybody right off the bat that might have been a turnoff to I know sometimes when you deal with witnesses,
right.
If y'all have the same set of beliefs or parallels, that you can kind of find some common ground. Sometimes you might be, just in general with anything in life, you kind of might be just a little wary of going back and speaking with another person. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and I think the hardest part for me was just saying, well, is this person telling the truth or is this person not telling the truth? I really, some people who look bad and they have made some stuff up, they might actually be telling the truth about one aspect of it, or something did happen, but they might have exaggerated a lot. It's very hard for me to make that determination, and that's probably why I just, I took myself out of the equation of judgment, I guess.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of why I dropped really investigating cases after probably the first year or two, and I kind of just worked on assigning cases to the other investigators in the state of Virginia from MUFON. I kind of became the assistant state director pseudo, and then I became officially, I think, in 2010 or 2011, somewhere around there, assistant state director for Virginia MUFON, helping out with conferences and things like that. But a long, cool experience. I can't take away. No one can really take away from the whole. Everybody had their importance of who I had to run across in those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I did something similar where when I got involved, I did tons of research, and then I got to the point where I had read practically everything, I think, and so my next step was to become an investigator like you, and I went into it like you with an open mind just to kind of see what was going on. I was surprised at first with how credible the witnesses were that I, some of them that I had spoke with. But I think a lot of people are like you, and I think that's what a lot of people don't realize is ultimately your best case scenario is that you mark a case unknown.
Right.
And that's not too exciting, where it's like you're not really finding anything out. You're just kind of like sometimes you have a strong feeling that it's mysterious. Sometimes you think, well, maybe there's an explanation, but I can't find it. So the range of what an unknown could be is wide. But when you come down to, I just don't know what it is, mark it unknown and then move on. And it's kind of like people want bigger answers, but they're just not there.
Yeah. I think when I used to read the MUFON Journal still when I had a subscription, I stopped getting it earlier this year just for cost effectiveness. But somebody had wrote in there, I'm pretty sure, or in an email I saw from MUFON, investigators shouldn't be scared of the insufficient data label on a case.
Right.
We shouldn't try to invent a label, to fit, just make more of one particular category populate in the overall list of citing cases.
Yeah, because, really, then all your unknowns, for the most part, you don't have deficient information. That's what it comes down to.
Gotcha.
Because I agree with you. When people were looking for that insufficient data kind of category, best case scenario at a great unknown, you still have a lack of data. You would always like more data because even if it's genuinely mysterious, it's just that mysterious. You don't have enough data to identify what it is, even if it is something extremely exotic.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Did you have a favorite case or some cases that are a case that you thought, wow, this is pretty incredible?
One case. I always usually mention this when somebody asks me, but in terms of my investigations, I did a radio interview on a local morning show that's really popular down here, and the only purpose of me doing the whole show in terms of feedback that I got was to get in contact with a guy who turned out to be a retired police officer in Virginia Beach, and he went on to tell me when I interviewed him about a wave of sightings that happened here in 1975 that basically was the summer, you know, really hot, and the police department was getting calls from all over the city from various people, and this was still when most of the city was pretty much rural. There were some, you know, urban areas that had built up around the oceanfront or the main drag of Virginia Beach Boulevard. But a lot of the city was still kind of rural, still growing up. All these people who normally probably don't even call the police or would never even dream of it were calling in. And there were white and red orbs, spheres, you know, spherical objects that were being seen by everyone, it seemed like. And that was the main theme that this guy, the retired police officer, had heard about, because he saw similar ones, and he actually chased after them with another officer. They were sitting on duty very late one night, probably 12, 1 in the morning, and they'd see it's probably about 4 objects in the front, either white or red, I can't remember, and then one object in the back kind of trailing that was the opposite color, white or red, and they were describing them kind of like glass globes that would have had an interior lighting that kind of pulsated bright and dark as they went. And the front 4 were kind of bobbing up and down, and the back one was static, kind of just moving along in a straight line. But that was really interesting. He chased them with the other guy that he was in another car. They were kind of talking to each other, how cops do when they pull side by side in 2 cars. And they drove flying down from the most rural part of Virginia Beach into more in the city towards the oceanfront, because that was the direction these things were going, towards the north. And during this pursuit, he called on the radio to see if Oceana had anything on the radar to the police dispatch. And they came back saying, no, there's nothing on the radar. That's what they said. But a few minutes later, these jets came in, and he described them as being armed, because they had to have been there's always like a certain amount of jets, like 4 or 5, that are always on the ready to go out. If there's some kind of urgent issue that needs to be addressed within the local airspace or far away or whatever, he described them as being armed, and they flew ahead. They flew over top of them so low that you could read the wing numbers off of them. And these jets were trying to keep up with the objects, but one by one, the spheres shot out over the ocean front towards the east. And he just described it as, when I saw the movie Star Wars, a few years later, that's kind of what it looked like, that it just, went into hyperdrive or whatever you want to call it. So that was his encounter, and that was during this wave of sightings, and he hadn't heard about the wave of sightings. A week later, he actually encountered a couple on the side of the road. When he had pulled them over, he thought that their van matched description of an armed robbery suspect. The couple was so scared, they kept on saying, did you see him? Did you see him? And he's like, did you see what? And he's like, not what, who? Or I can't remember who or what, whatever they, but it was just very intense. They were shaken up by seeing these red spheres that had landed in a field, a farmer's field. And the week before, the guy had seen the same thing, and so he knew kind of what they were talking about. And yeah, those were his two direct experiences. After that one, he had heard from the chief dispatcher that, you know, everybody's calling in about these things. And the most amazing part of the whole scenario is that I looked in the newspaper files for the Virginia Pilot, local newspaper, you know, nothing in there for that time frame. And the news channels, I tried making requests to them, but they don't, apparently they don't, you know, either they don't solicit them to the public or whatever. They don't let you have access to their films from that era. It seemed like nobody was giving me anything. So, you know, I don't know, they just destroy them. I can't imagine they just, you know, destroy them. But so it's an unknown wave of sightings. And apparently the last part of the story is kind of like a Men in Black aspect, that him and the other officer who saw the things that they chased after in the sky, they got interviewed by two guys that claimed they were from the Center for UFO Studies, and they showed them real IDs, and they were wearing like gray suits at the precinct. They came in, you know, talked to their supervisor, and they were waiting for them when they got back off duty. And you know, they filled out diagrams, had the real report forms, but when this guy, the retired police officer, tried to get in touch with Center for UFO Studies years later to find a record of this, they didn't really have a record. And I emailed Mark Rodiger asking him, you know, would this be something that they, you know, would have done back then in 1975? And he kind of, you know, was of the opinion that we didn't really have a big budget back then. You know, we wouldn't have really heard about this, and we wouldn't have really had the money to go out and go after it anyway. And so that story, I think, is striking to me just in the aspect of what could have happened elsewhere in the world, you know, in the country, that we just don't know about. So.
Right. Yeah, really interesting, especially the police sightings are always really important because, and I think revealing in that, a lot of people go to the police when they have a sighting, and when you read the police stories, the police are just as baffled and really helpless discovering what these things are as a normal person would be when they have their own sightings.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're left with, what the heck was that? So that's cool case, pretty interesting. So you eventually moved towards, and it said you developed a big interest in the real early cases. And from the title of your book, you know, it's called The Restored Project Blue Book UFO Files, June 1947 and before. So that is really early on in the phenomena. And what in particular strikes you about the early cases?
I've always had an interest in history and, you know, historical things. So that kind of what spoke to me about the early cases, and also the fact that they're kind of military oriented and how they're presented. A lot of them do have, if you've ever looked at any Blue Book documents, you know, depending on the amount of documents available per sighting, per case, whatever you want to call it, there could be, you know, military documents to go along with it, or just a letter from somebody that's all that's left in the files, or, you know, a newspaper article. It just depends on what's kind of survived. But, you know, that in 2005, what really, I looked on the internet, you know, did some research. When I first started looking, this website wasn't there. I always had heard about Blue Book, you know, and it was always the quote in the shows that I would see, like, you know, and the Air Force explained all the cases away kind of in Project Blue Book as, you know, being nothing going on. So,
right.
Yeah, and it turns out there was a website that went online that I quote in the book. It's bluebookarchive.org. Through the help of what I found out later was many different researchers and groups, they posted a bunch of the scans of the Blue Book documents from the National Archives as well as from other private sources where people had preserved original actual Air Force microfilms, reels of photographs basically taken of the documents and put onto a reel that you can read in a microfilm machine. And up until this website going online in 2005, really, there was no way to see anything about Blue Book except in books, a few excerpts, a few pictures of documents, unless you went to the National Archives, or unless you went to Keene or had the original reels yourself, and that you could order from the archives, and you bought them and then went to the library in your local area that had a microfilm reader to take a look at them. But it just had no real access to for the public beyond the National Archives. And in 2005, when a lot of the a lot of them are on there, but a lot of them still remain to be posted on this website that I quote in the book. Seeing the originals, that's really what struck me. And also, the person who was basically the person who operated the website, and it's still maintained by the same person. Her name is Rebecca Wise, and she worked with a bunch of groups like the Fund for UFO Research and Center for UFO Studies, Project 1947, and all of these sources kind of gave her the records, the reels of microfilm to scan. She scanned them into the website. She created the website, wrote all the code and everything. And it's a really good resource, even though it's incomplete. It still is very good. And that website's bluebookarchive.org. But the website is really cool for somebody like me who's a historical person. And, I like looking at raw data, kind of raw documents. But for average person, you might get turned off by it after, looking at it for so long as it hurts your eyes to stare at these highly contrasted, scans of the microfilms, where when they're photographed to become microfilm from the paper document, it's getting this picture taken and it's put on a roll, that you can look at on a big reader. Luckily, you can scan these in digitally, but each time you do something with it, so much is lost of the original document. So originally, when they were microfilmed, a lot of them, it's not a very good read, and some text is even missing. And that was really what inspired me to work on this restoration. That's kind of what I've termed it. And that website, the Blue Book Archive, the curator, Rebecca Wise, she had wrote on there, the goal of the next few years is to kind of have a searchable index so people can transcribe a page, upload it, and then we can search, have a searching way to search the files instead of, just a date range of what's supposed to be in this segment of one film of microfilm, where, there could be documents for that particular case or sighting you're looking for spread out, out of place, or just another reel that you would never think to look. So, kind of a complicated, complex thing I'm trying to describe. But if anyone goes on that website, they would kind of instantly know what I'm talking about. So.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting I love about that era is that even though you look at the press is kind of similar to today. Some of them make fun of it. Some of them don't. Some of them, even if they take the story serious, kind of throw in a couple of silly things, kind of just like today. But when you look at the Air Force's investigations, they were extremely serious about the whole thing. I love that. That's what I love about the tenor of the investigations back then. Where now, you know, they're dismissive, where they don't even look into things. Reading those files are exciting because of how serious they take them.
Right, exactly. And that's one thing I love about it. It basically is a snapshot of an era when the Air Force, the military, the government, whatever you want to call it, they had to look into a case when you submitted it. And with how hard it was back then, you know, we're, as now, you know, you can Google whatever and find out what you have to do anything. People really had to work hard to submit their information. And on top of that, a lot of the cases weren't really quite like just from the general public. They were from, you know, Air Force's own pilots, scientific observers, you know, just various people that you wouldn't, you know, it's not just kind of kooky people that, you know, think they saw something, but they, you know, maybe they didn't. It's a very good historical record of I think everything that could be gathered in that time frame.
I think another thing that's exciting and a lot of people don't realize, and that's what's kind of neat about you tackling these earlier cases, is that, you know, Project Signed, which started at the end of 1947 and ended in 48, they concluded that, and this was the Air Force's paper and conclusion, that some of these things weren't Russian, they weren't U.S., and they possibly were extraterrestrial in origin, which, yeah, a lot of people don't know, is that the Air Force's first conclusion was that there could be, some of these could be E.T. craft.
Right, exactly. And then, unfortunately, it was about, I think that was in February 1949, or some, that was when Project Sign, like, published their findings. But I know before that there was that unofficial document that circulated. Well, it was official, but it's, you know, unofficial now because it's disappeared and it was all destroyed. But yeah, they did conclude it was ET. And then when they sent it up to the higher headquarters, then they kind of battered it back down, saying, you know, whatever personality, ego wanted, you know, wanted to do it, you know, they said, you know, put this away. I never want to see this hypothesis again.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Which got him upset. Yeah. And that's what's funny about, you know, if you read Ruppelt's book, who worked on, started Project Blue Book up, he says, you know, Project Grudge, essentially, the name was appropriate because they were pretty upset that this original group put this extraterrestrial hypothesis in there. And so then they're, mandate became to debunk everything.
Yeah, then, you know, 6-8 months later, they issued the Grudge report, and that kind of ended any optimism of finding the actual answer, because everybody just has either hallucinates from and has mild hysteria from or war nerves and misinterprets known craft. That's pretty much all we do in psychological factors.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all crazy. I don't know what we're talking about.
So looking at these early files, it's kind of like a treasure hunt, I would imagine, where you're looking for and probably getting really excited when you come across, you know, some really cool cases, some really interesting cases. What were some of those treasures that you found that are in the book?
I think I will say that, you know, just a basic simple report I thought was very, very interesting. It was in Richmond and Virginia in 1947. And the bad thing about Blue Book, the official listing of cases, it kind of chopped off everything before June 1947, and in the Project Sign rolls of microfilm, those are the ones that were preserved in civilian hands, kind of, in Project 1947. Jan Aldrich, he has those original rolls. you get the whole story because those were produced before the project became Blue Book and before the project became Grudge even, and before these ever went out for public consumption in the National Archives and at National Air Force Base prior to that for the public to view. And with the Kenneth Arnold case, since that happened in June 1947, that was kind of like the big beginning of, you know, the press era, the press interest of it. And some people still think even, you know, that that was the first UFO sighting, but, you know, we obviously know it wasn't. a very simple case from April 1947 in Richmond, Virginia. There was some Weather Bureau observers who would look through their theodolite telescope at the weather balloons each day. And I think it was, yeah, three different people. One of the witnesses read the letter, and each person saw it basically was saucers, and they described them as, you know, flat on the bottom, a dome on the top, shiny silver, kind of dull. And this is all just viewed through their normal aspect of their job that they normally do each day. And that couldn't have happened just to that one weather bureau. So, you know, just reading it in a very vivid way that they describe it in a very simplistic way, it just kind of, I mean, that for me, I mean, it's a very simple sighting, but it's very credible, and it's very easy to interpret, you know, exactly what they're looking at. They're not looking at the flying flapjack plane that, you know, couldn't really, there was only so many of them in the country, and, you know, obviously those have propellers, and, you know, some of the other ones that were saucer-shaped that we tried to make happen in as experimental planes, you know, they weren't looking at that by the description. And, you know, so that's one kind of case. I know it's anybody who's listening that really has looked in the Blue Book or read a lot of cases, they probably know what that one is. But, you know, the thing is, a lot of this is already been out there, but if you haven't read it or haven't looked at it kind of in this way, it is a refreshing look and at these cases from June 1947 and prior, as well as if you've never looked at Blue Book before, it gives you a very user-friendly, you know, not eye-straining ability to read these files legibly. And I think the last statement I kind of want to make just about content-wise is about Kenneth Arnold's case, and that's included in this volume. You know, June 24th, 1947 was when he kind of began our new era of UFO.
Right. I mean, it prompted the Air Force into getting involved with research.
Yes. And I saw probably, I would say in 04, 05, somewhere around there. It had been not too long before I read up on these documents, but an entire show on the Discovery Channel or TLC, whichever it was, devoted one episode. It was like a series that kind of looked at unsolved mysteries of history or whatever. I'm not going to say the name of the show, even though I want to, but they devoted an entire episode to disproving or solving the Kenneth Arnold sighting by, in the end, saying that there were reflections. What he saw was just reflections upon his windshield of his plane from an unknown light source, like how, you know, light will reflect on your window as you're driving, and it kind of startles you at first, but then you realize, oh, it's just a reflection or a flash of something else that reflected. But the only problem is that if this show, these producers who, you know, wasted their time essentially in producing the show, if they would have read the original statement by Kenneth Arnold, it says that essentially what caught his attention was a bright, very bright mirror-like flash that caught him in the eye, and he basically, when he looked, you know, after he kind of saw these things that were looked like metallic, they would kind of flip and catch the sunlight and reflect like a mirror while he's flying his plane. And he turned his entire plane so that he could kind of parallel them, and then he opened his window to look and see, you know, are these, you know, is this some kind of optical illusion, you know, through my windshield or what? So, you know, it's just kind of sad that, and I can't, you know, blame the show, I guess, because they didn't take a trip to the National Archives to actually look at the source material for, you know, maybe they should have, but, you know, this was probably before a lot of this was available online, but they just didn't do that good a job because the witness, you know, that they tried to disprove and say he was startled by some flash on his windshield and kept on looking at the same flash on his windshield for several minutes on end, you know, they could have looked at a simple, his statement, his actual written statement, and he opened his window in his plane and, you know, viewed them with his naked eye without any obstruction. And these objects were still doing the same thing. So.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunate with a lot of these shows because I've found with the majority of them having worked with some is that it's typically quick and dirty. It's like, you know, wherever we can find some information fast, not necessarily adhering to being thorough or doing thorough investigations. It's just getting some information really quick so we could shoot and get the show off.
Exactly.
Out the door. I wanted to touch on a couple things before we're done here that you said in this really interesting interview with a local, looks like a local paper, the HamptonRoads.com. I thought they did a good job with an interview with you on there. But there was a couple interesting things you said. One of the things that kind of makes a lot of sense, especially with the research you've done, is Close Encounters of the Third Kind being your favorite movie. But for me, that's one of my favorite movies. But going when you do the research, especially the type you've done with the early cases, and then you watch the movie, I mean, it takes on a completely different form, at least for me, in that you really see the parallels, especially in the beginning, to the sightings they were having and some of the old cases, especially like even with the case you were talking about earlier, with the cops chasing things around.
Yeah, and now I will correct and say they asked me what my favorite UFO movie was.
Oh,
so
right.
Probably, yeah, if that was my favorite movie of all time, then yeah, I might be a little stuck in just one genre of
life. Okay. You wouldn't be the only one.
Yeah, so, but yeah, you know, I noticed that too, watching it once when I was just kind of beginning to do some research in UFOs and then coming back into it again after I'd already, you know, done a lot of research, it kind of does have a very classic feel to it, and that's what I really love about the movie.
And it's always exciting to see Hynek on the screen.
Exactly.
So that's pretty cool. That's pretty funny. And it's funny you say that, that you're UFO-inspired. And now that I think about it, I couldn't say what's my number one favorite, but I could say what are maybe my five favorite. And probably three of those are UFO alien-related.
Gotcha.
And then another answer, and I think that you put this really well, and I think it's another thing that kind of surprises people when they start getting involved in this sort of field, is they asked you what are some of the challenges you face as a leader of a UFO club, and you talked about how everybody has different beliefs, and I like this quote, ufology is similar to religion in that there are many ways to believe in the same overall theme.
Yes.
And some people hold very dearly or very tightly to those views that they have.
Yes, it's it's very true. And as I said before, you know, everyone kind of has their, I would say, you know, the fact that everyone has their part to play, everyone has their own beliefs, and my viewpoint when I did the club was kind of as a moderator, if you want to call it that, not someone who's really going to, it wasn't my point to express my own beliefs. When someone would ask a question, I would try to answer it in a way that didn't really, you know, turn them, because honestly, when I was searching for answers my own self, when I started this, you know, I knew that little things that I would run across would shape, I realized later, would shape the next years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I kind of have a very cautious attitude of how far I express my own beliefs, and really, you know, after doing this for a number of years and working with a bunch of different people with the club and investigations, we really still, I really still, you know, can't say what's going on. You know, I don't know. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people who do say they know, and that's mm-hmm. just based on their own experience, which, you know, that's fine. I think it's all, you know, what the mix of it is, what the part each person plays is equally important. But, you know, so I kind of take a step back and just, you know, let everybody make their own judgments, and I don't
right.
really make too many. Unless they're, you know, they're going to kill somebody, but they're what they're,
yeah.
you know, you're trying to do something, you know, really, you know, if it doesn't hurt anybody, then, you know, that kind of is the way to go, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to do it. It's being respectful that other people have opinions and respecting their opinions. And then I think it's important, if you do, like you said, express personal opinions, to frame it that way. Let them know, well, here's what I feel. I don't know, but here's what I think, if you're pressed to do so, because you do have to be careful when you're running one of those organizations.
Exactly, exactly.
And then finally, I think this is a good way to end it. I liked your answer, or I found it interesting, when you were asked if you felt there would be verification of a communication with aliens in your lifetime. And do you remember your answer?
Yes, I believe I said along the lines of there would have to be live contact on CNN for all to see before there would be any real gigantic earth shift in terms of belief. And when I'm kind of exaggerating a little bit more than what I said, but you know, a giant shift in consciousness toward belief or disclosure, or you know, whatever your goal is you have in mind when you're interested in stuff or doing this stuff. And at the same time, I believe I said it's kind of up to the occupants of who's behind the scenes, because the occupants of the objects, whether they're occupied or not, which, you know, some might be, some might not be. And
right.
that, you know, if they really wanted everyone to know who they were, they would do it. You know, I mean, that was the thing, you know. They would, you know, make a point to shift our consciousness for us if that was their goal. You know, there's nothing really stopping them.
Right. I think that concept makes a lot of sense. I think the first time that really hit home with me was talking with Nick Pope, and he said, you know, he felt that this thing was really event-led, and who is creating these events, or who, you know, who makes these events happen? Well, whatever they are, you know, whoever is behind, you know, the craft or whatever. And so, And that kind of, I guess, gives me – a lot of people get frustrated. Why don't they do this? Why doesn't this happen? Why doesn't that happen? And it's kind of like, you know, we're not really on our timeline. We're on someone else's timeline. And you've got to kind of just be patient, I think, in that whenever whoever it is feels like they need to come say hi on CNN, like you said, then that'll happen. But until then, we're kind of left in this limbo that we've kind of been trapped in since 1947.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So,
well, great.
Yeah, great.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And the book is called Restored Project Blue Book UFO Files, June 1947 and before. And people can find this on Amazon. And is that the best place for people to go to get it?
Yes, absolutely. It's available on Amazon in the U.S. and also the Amazon Europe websites.
Perfect.
As well.
All right. And they can also, on Amazon, you can also look for Cameron Pack if you wanted to be sure you find the right book. But that's where people can find it. Do you have a website or anything else you wanted to point people towards?
Not at this time, no.
Okay.
No.
Perfect. So go check out Amazon. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
No problem. I really appreciate it, Alejandro.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun and really interesting, and good luck with your future endeavors. Are you planning to do after 1947?
Yes, yes. I think my goal should at least be to do a July 1947 volume, and that has a lot more content, I think, with all the press coverage that was going on then, and you know, everybody getting excited. So that should be even better than the June 1947 volume. So,
all right, cool. And
hopefully next year. So,
and it's interesting for people to know that even there is enough content to do that with just, you know, 1 month's worth of material to create a whole entire book on.
And it is very painstaking, you know, to make sure you have it correct and get the format right to the originals as much as possible. But it was fun, and you know, so I think I would look forward to doing it July 47, and you know, the sky's the limit on where you can go from there. There's 21 more years worth of months and cases to do. So I don't think I could ever do this in my lifetime. So anyone else who wants to
help out,
do a detailed account, please feel free.
All right, great. Well, for a UFO geek like me, this is your efforts are much appreciated.
Thank you, thank you. And I much appreciate you allowing me to be on the show today.
All right, thank you to Cameron Pack. And remember, you can go to Amazon. You know, I went to Amazon and I just looked up Blue Book 1947, and I was able to find the book pretty easy. So that's the best way to go look for it. And I think it's just really important for researchers, because then you have all of these great files. Don't forget to check out our magazine, too. In our next magazine, we've got an article on some Blue Book case. So that's really cool, something to check out. And, of course, I want to remind you about the Congress, because that's coming up, and tickets are going really quick right now. And, of course, my listeners are some of the coolest people in this field. So we want you all to come to the conference, and we have really good speakers. We've got Timothy Good. I'm excited about this one, too. Aaron Sagers, who's become a kind of a buddy of ours, who did Paranormal Paparazzi. He shows up all over the place. He's worked for CNN and MTV, writing about the paranormal. He goes to a lot of these conferences, and he's going to be talking about UFOs and celebrities. So really cool stuff. And then our panel of scientists is really exciting. We have Robert Schroeder, who is on the show, talking about UFO propulsion. Really interesting ideas, and hopefully he'll bounce those across some of the other scientists we have, such as Jeffrey Bennett, who's an astrophysicist. I saw him speak in North Carolina recently, and he talks about, you know, SETI and the mainstream search for life and some incredibly interesting ideas. He's really cool, a lot of fun, a great talk. And this one's really exciting. Richard Hoover, who's a NASA scientist, and he is working with some of the people in England. We've written some of these stories recently, But he works, he's an astrobiologist out of Athens State University, but he works with the University of Buckingham and with some of his partners out there in England. There's a group of scientists who believe that there are several places now where that demonstrate and are evidence of extraterrestrial life that have come to this planet. So they believe, you know, that life has been seeded, the panspermia idea, that it comes from space and lands on our planet, and that's where life comes from. But they believe there's evidence from rocks from Mars and other meteorites. They believe that possibly this red rain demonstrates some extraterrestrial biological bacteria and things that have come from space into our planet. And also, they've done an experiment recently where they put a balloon up in the atmosphere and they caught some bacteria and things that they think are extraterrestrial. So he's going to talk about all of this evidence that they believe, including the Viking landings even from back in the day, some of the first landers that went to Mars, and how some of that evidence they believe is demonstrates there's extraterrestrial life on Mars. So a lot of really interesting stuff in that maybe some of the data that we've already received already demonstrates there's extraterrestrial life out there. So this is really exciting because him and his partners keep making a lot of news. So we've got a lot of great speakers, so you're going to want to check that out. Remember, go to UFOCongress.com to see the rest of the list of the speakers. So thank you once again for joining us on Open Minds Radio. I'm going to try really hard. We got a short week, of course, with the holiday this week. Try really hard to do another show next week. But if not, then I will talk to you either next week or the week after. And, of course, as usual, I want to thank the people who donated the music because it's so cool. Our opening music from Caleb Hanks and then the closed music from Two Earth Minutes. But thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you in a week or two. Adios, muchachos.